People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio and Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, I'm very excited to tell you about this. I wonder if you saw the film Moffy. Well, a stage adaptation of this internationally acclaimed production has come home for a South African premiere at the Baxter, running from the 2nd to the 27th of September. It's based on the novel by André Carl van der Merwe, and this stage adaptation has been brought to life by really a stellar South African team, as you'll hear, in a powerful, poignant sharing of this story about love, survival, and identity under apartheid. And the director is Greg Carvelis, who is a theatre director and producer with over two decades of experience in the industry. And you may remember him, he was the inaugural artistic director of the Fugard Theatre here in Cape Town and now lives in Berlin. So Greg, welcome. Welcome back to Cape Town.
Thank you very much.
Have you come back especially for this production?
Yes, I've come back especially to stage Moffy.
With the stage adaptation, how did that come about, and how are you involved that it became a stage adaptation from the film?
So, as you said in your wonderful intro, the original, the source material is the book by André Carl van der Merwe, mm-hmm. which was written in 2006, or at least published in 2006, to great acclaim. I mean, it's a really special book.
A powerful book as well.
Yeah. And
scary even.
And scary, yeah. And very deeply personal mm-hmm. as well. That then was actually made into a dance production at the Grahamstown Festival in 2015 Goodness. By Bailey Sneyman, if my memory is serving correct. And then Eric Abraham, who I think some people might remember, who founded and funded the Fugard Theatre and who was also an Academy Award winning film producer in his own right, then got the rights for the book to then do the film version in 2019, which was directed by Oliver Hermanis. Mm-hmm. After the Fugard closed, I continued to work with Eric to help pack in the Fugard, archive it. We turned the website into this beautiful archive, which exists today at thefugard.com. And out of some discussions with Eric, he proposed the ideas, what would I think of turning the novel into a stage production? So not the film into a stage production, but rather the source material, the novel, into a stage production, but as a monologue play. And I was intrigued. I was obviously very familiar with the book, having read it, mm-hmm. but also because of Eric's involvement with Moffy, the film was very close to it. And I said to him, I think that's great. I think we should give it a try. So I approached Philip Rademeyer, excellent, I think, in my estimation, one of the best writers we have in the country, and said to him, would you like to take a crack at an adaptation? and so it happened. And so we began to adapt it, and Philip turned it into the version we're seeing today. I mean, obviously there was an early version and now there's the version after doing the run in London. And that's how it came about.
But the London run apparently was hugely successful. There are all sorts of quotes here from people about how powerful it was and what an extraordinary piece of theatre it was.
Yeah, absolutely. So we chose to do it in London. Kai Luke Brummer, who starred in the film, we approached him to be in the monologue in the stage adaptation, and he's based in London and I'm based in Berlin. So the feeling was that it would be easier for us to workshop it, rehearse it, and then open it in London. And I mean, obviously I was very excited to open it and really hoping people would like it, but the response we got back was incredible. And interestingly, we obviously had a big South African contingent. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Moffy is a word that is used quite liberally in South Africa. It's not a nice word.
No, it's not a nice word. It's derogatory.
It's derogatory. It's absolutely derogatory.
And it's only applicable in South Africa. It's not used.
Well, this is what was so interesting, is that when we were in London, it was, how do we, obviously South Africans will identify that, but you know, obviously wanted a British audience. I mean, you know, the constituencies there. And it really kind of exploded. And the reactions we got afterwards were sort of, initially people were just stunned. And then and then also I started to realize that there were so many people who were still living with so many similar experiences and experiences in the world of the story. Both men who identified as gay and do identify and then and now, but also straight men that went through conscription, mm-hmm. you know, in the late 70s and the 80s.
And for many people caused a good deal of psychological damage, whether they were straight or gay.
Absolutely, absolutely. And many of these men were, certainly when we were in the London run, were people that had actually left South Africa because of that trauma. Mm-hmm. it was quite amazing to see that. And again, I didn't anticipate such a big reaction, but I'm thrilled that we got it.
And now this is a premiere in South Africa, isn't it, at the Baxter? This is the first time this one-man show is going to be seen here in South Africa.
Absolutely. After opening it in London, very much the next step was for us to bring it to South Africa.
Yeah.
The creative team, I mean, we're all South Africans. Even Kai, who's based in London, is South Africa. But David Viviers, who's now taken on the role of Nicholas, is Cape Town-based. So it's a real Cape Town-based South African team.
Yeah. It just amazes me because I have to say I haven't seen the film. Although I've seen trailers, I've spoken to friends who've seen it, knowing that I was going to interview you. And, you know, the film is big. It's got casts, big cast, and out there and trains and goodness knows what else. How on earth do you bring it down to one person? That must have been a huge challenge for the chap who you've just said. What was his name?
So Philip Rademaker.
Philip Rademaker.
Yeah. And David Vivier is now stepping in the role as the actor.
Right.
Yeah, this was the big challenge. You know, the book is quite dense. I mean, mm-hmm. The story is, as I said, very personal. It's actually based on André Carle's diaries. And he shared with us that he actually wrote those diaries and actually locked them away for 20 years. And then one day sort of like was like, all right, I've got to confront this, and read the diaries. And then the book came out of that. So it's deeply personal. And it's exactly how do we take the whole experience and immerse the audience in that. And that's a key word for me, is that we've really aimed to immerse the audience. We've got Charles-Johan Lingenfelder, who many people will know.
Yes.
From basically, he works on every single show.
He's the music director.
He's the musical director and the sound designer, and he's composed some music for it. He actually went through a similar experience. He actually served. He was conscripted in. And many people will remember his movie Canary, which was based on his.
Yeah. That's right.
So what Charles has brought is this incredibly visceral. He's brought the sounds of the border to the audience,
wow,
which is quite terrifying.
Yes.
I'm 43 years old. I was only born in 82, so I missed conscription by a mile. But even for me, hearing the sound of the buffalo and the soundscapes that he's created, and we really surround the audience with the sound, yeah, makes it visceral.
Mm. And so goose fleshy, because remembering those sounds that one did when one went to.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is what a lot of people reacted to, is you know. Then we've got Neil Griffin, who's done the full design. So set, lighting, we have some projection elements in there, as well as the costume. And he's brought this it's very stripped back, but incredibly detailed set, which the action takes place on.
All right, I want to ask you more about that set in a moment, because it's important, apparently, from what I've read, for the mood of the whole play.
Yeah.
But let's have your first choice of music, Greg. What have you chosen for us?
Great. I have chosen Big in Japan by Alphaville.
Right.
And why? Why did I choose this? It's one of those songs that has been on my playlist for years. And whenever it comes on, it just makes me feel happy. I don't know why. And, you know, being an 80s baby, I think it's just part of my childhood. I think I grew up with it, and that's why I chose it.
Yeah.
That's called Big in Japan, and it was by Group Alphaville. And the first choice of my guest this week on People of Note, Greg Carvalhas, who is here because he's just directed a stage adaptation of Moffy, which many people may know as a film or certainly the book. We were speaking, Greg, just before the music about Neil and his design. And you mentioned detail because I've interviewed him a few times, Neil Griffin, and his attention to detail and how he makes a set look is actually quite extraordinary. Do you agree? And presumably he's done that here.
Absolutely. I've worked with Neil on a couple of productions and a film, actually, a couple of years ago. And it's the Neil magic. It's the Neil Griffin effect. He puts so much of himself into his design and nothing is left untouched. And I'll give your audience a little Easter egg for those that come and watch, is that on the army bags, which were known as Bullsucker in the army, he's handmade and hand-painted the clips, which the audience can't actually see.
Okay.
He's handmade. The set is comprised of a pile of army bags, which represents a whole bunch of things. It represents trauma, emotional baggage, body bags, memory. It's a whole universe. And he's handmade each bag. He has hand-stained it so that it is absolutely accurate, historically accurate, to the point that even Charles Johan, who, as I said, went to the army, was like, these look like the real, real bags.
My goodness.
You know, his attention to detail. And I think the audience sometimes might not always get it. It's sort of literally, but my belief is that an audience feels it. They feel the artistic choices and it adds to the immersion. Mm-hmm. And that was the brief I gave all of us as a team, is I want the audience, for those that went through that horrible experience, to give them an opportunity to confront it, to remember, to reckon with it, to maybe have some healing. And for those of us that weren't there, is to get a real sense of what that was like, because mm-hmm. that then breeds empathy and understanding. And as we all know in the world, and I live in Europe now, pre-war Europe, as they're calling it,
is
a very real world. This isn't in the, you know, 70s, 80s apartheid. This conscription, I mean, in Germany, they're talking about conscription.
They are indeed, you know, because of the whole Russia-Ukraine threat.
Yeah.
It's rather scary to hear you say pre-war Europe. Yeah. Now
that's what they're saying. So, you know, it really begs the question of, you know, this is what the play on many levels is asking us, is where did we come from and where are we headed? And the design by Neil and the sound by Charles really locks that in and immerses the audience in that world.
You say there are all these bags on the stage. It's like a big set, hundreds of bags.
No, it's a pile of army bags. Mm-hmm. There are other elements to the set, so it's not just that.
Right. Oh, okay.
You know, one of the things we've had to do for this run is we were at the Riverside in London, which is a slightly smaller venue. We're now at the Baxter Flipside, which is a nice big high space. So we've really stretched the visual aesthetic
out. I don't know what you mean, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very much, I want the audience to feel like they are in Nicholas's head, that we are seeing these snapshots of memory and trauma and the things that he went through. And André Carl, you know, by extension of his book.
But then obviously lighting must play a big part as well.
Well, these things dance together. You know, as Neil puts it so beautifully, is, you know, with the lighting, he's working in shadow. It's very often the stuff we don't show the audience, but then that's where the sound fills in.
Yeah, yeah.
And these two things dance with each other. And then you've got David, who's just absolutely brilliant. It's a big job to step into a role like that.
Yeah.
And that's in rehearsal. What we've worked really hard at is to choreograph it so it all feels like one thing.
How did you find him, this actor? That David. Did you do a whole lot of auditions?
Can I tell you, David is an actor I've always wanted to work with. We've never had the opportunity. He's incredibly well known in the TV space, the theater space. He's an author in his own
right. That's right. I see that he's written, yes.
Yes, yeah. So he was always someone, he's always been in my, sort of in the ether and in my mind. And Kai couldn't come and do the Cape Town run because he's got film and television commitments. And the next name that popped into my head was David Viviers.
Oh, okay.
And I actually, another Easter egg for the audience, decided if David can't do it, then we're just going to have to delay the season and do it some other time until it just naturally, it was a very organic thing. And I'm in my middle age, I'm learning to trust my instincts.
Okay, that's a good thing, especially as a director.
Yeah.
And presumably it's quite a draining role for him as well, from what I've read about it all. It's a role, we've been speaking about the honesty and the trauma of it all. It must be quite a role to play.
Absolutely. It's, as we've said in rehearsals, it's a marathon. Just in terms of the amount, I mean, it's 85 minutes And it is pretty much nonstop monologuing.
You don't have an interval.
We don't have an interval. And again, I've done that on purpose in that I want the feeling to feel concentrated and condensed and the audience to really just get locked in.
Mm.
But David has got such a wonderful sense of it, of the character. He's bringing his own experiences into it. I mean, this is one thing that many people said to us in London is that by the time it ends, they're kind of... It's certainly not a feeling of like it's a slog,
yeah,
but it is a big story. And we've tried to, you know, it's a bit like dynamite in a paint tin,
okay,
is maybe one way to put it.
Have you had any kind of emotional reaction from audiences or traumatic reactions who've come to you or come backstage quite distraught at having had all these memories?
Definitely. In London, we had many people who would sit for 20 minutes sometimes after a show. And we were very mindful of that, of also creating that space for them. It is for many people a very, very hard story to revisit. You know, Charles and we've already worked on one season of the show. Even coming back to it, you know, it brings up a lot of memories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is important because the border war, you know, and this part of South African history is not something that's been explored very much.
It's not. And isn't that interesting?
It's very interesting. And it's coming to the fore now. It's coming. There's a I've just been at Silver Scarum, and there's actually a documentary series that's coming out on Showmax, which is actually exploring the border war. But that's really it. I mean, there's lots of stuff from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and from the late 90s. But again, the theme that comes up is so many of these men who were boys when they went there just don't talk about it. They can't talk about it. It's locked in them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are men who are sitting in their 50s and 60s and 70s now, you know, who are still with us, who are still part of our society, you know, who have families, who have sons and daughters. And I watched a trailer for the Showmax series, and again, it was just the daughter saying her father would never speak about it, would just never speak about it. So this is why it's important.
I want to ask you just after this next music break about women's reactions to all of this, which I think is important because they didn't know anything about it. But let's have your next piece of music. At least it's something I know.
Yes. So the next song I've chosen is Golden Brown by the Stranglers. This is a bit morbid, so I hope it doesn't make people sad. But this is kind of my funeral song.
Oh, right.
This
okay.
is the song. Again, it's another song that makes me feel very, very happy. I just love it. And I've told my beautiful wife, Georgia, that if you ever have to lower me into the ground or put me in a jar, this is the song I'd like you to do it.
Texture like sun, lays me down. With my mind she runs throughout the night. No need to fight, never a frown. With golden brown, every time, just like the last. On her ship, tied to the mast. Two distant lands, takes both my hands. Never a frown with golden brown. Golden brown, fine temptress. Through the ages she's heading west. From far away, stays for a day. Never a frown with golden brown. Thank you.
Well, there's almost a golden oldie, a piece called Golden Brown by the Stranglers, and another choice of my guest on People of Note this week here on Fine Music Radio, Greg Carvalis. We're talking about the play called Moffy, which is opening at the Baxter on the 2nd of September. It runs right through till the 27th at the Baxter Flipside. And the extraordinary effect, this story of this chap who was gay, hiding that, presumably having to hide it, and yet having to deal with the trauma of the border war. And I mentioned just before, Greg, what about the women? Because no woman has ever been through that, and yet they've married men and become girlfriends and boyfriends of the men who were there. What sort of response do you get from women?
It's been another really interesting one of people that have come to see it and said, you know, this reminds me so much of my father, so much of my uncle, so much of my brother. You know, at the heart of it, as you say, this is about a young gay man, essentially a boy, really. I mean, when in the story he's conscripted at 17, he's still discovering himself, but he's absolutely having to shove these feelings down while trying to figure himself out. And then being in this highly masculine, toxic, kind of bigoted, you know, environment where there's
testosterone filled,
you know, yeah. There's a line in the book and in the play that we use is that nothing gentle can survive here. There's no space for emotion and feeling. And so the people that have come to watch it, who have known people like this that have gone to the border, really talk about, like, you know, it reminds me so much of my dad. He never spoke about it. We don't ask. We're not allowed to ask. And because that's the other level of this, it is the trauma of it. It's the trauma of war. It's the trauma of hate. It's the trauma of bigotry. And it's this thing of being, and the world, in my estimation, as free and as wonderful as it is, as we're living in this scary world where things are getting shoved into, you know, you pick, like, are you this or are you that? You got to pick a side. Mm. And you're
becoming marginalized.
Marginalized, you know. I had dinner with someone who said, you know, I just want to live in a world where there's A and B. And I said to him, that's fine, unless, you know, you're a C, a D, an E, or an F. You
exactly.
know? And then all of a sudden, A, B world. So it's been really interesting to see how, you know, and trauma works like this. It ripples out into families, and they're still feeling it today. And it's a, you know, I grew up with a stepfather who was on the border. You know, he was a great stepdad. I mean, he was very caring, but there was a lot of that. You know, there's another line in the book and in the play, suffer, baby, suffer. And I remember I was being taught to put up a tent at 5 years old, and he told me, suffer, baby, suffer. And it's like this feeling as a man, you know, that you've got to be a certain way in order to survive. Yeah, and I think that's dangerous.
In the play, as I said, I've not seen the film, certainly, but in this play, does this young man, does the fact that he's gay come out?
One of the big themes about this is, and it was something I spoke to Philip Rademacher, the writer, about, is, you know, what's at the core of this? And he said, you know, what we really want to focus on is the sense of safe spaces, you know. Certainly in this context, in the 70s and 80s, while the army didn't ban it outright, it was a sense that you really had to watch yourself.
Yes.
And you had to be very careful how you spoke, who you looked at. You were never, you know, and even when you were in a safe space, in air quotes, you still always had the sense of, like, looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
So this is a big theme we have of what that, and how that's formed people's psyches. And then people who were outed by various, whether they were caught, in inverted commas, or someone outed them, you know, then there's the specter of Ward 22, which is another little bit of dirty South African history, which was a psych ward where...
Ward 22.
Yes, where gay and lesbian men and women who were in the SADF were sent, drug addicts, people with mental health. You know, Dr. Levine, Aubrey Levine, was experimenting an aversion therapy. And there's a whole dark corner of the SADF.
And as you say, this doesn't come out. It hasn't come out.
It hasn't. And it's going to. And I mean, I think this is the start of it. And the Showmax documentary is the start of it.
Mm-hmm. Goodness me. And so with him on stage alone, is he able to project, and I'm sure he can, this business of being gay in this environment?
So we
and the suffering that he has to go through to hide it, possibly.
Our approach is his navigating his way through being conscripted, through dealing with a father who's very hard on him and says to him, be a man, don't be a moffy.
We've
heard this so many times. Into him going into basic training and making his way all the way to the border. And in the process, falling in love, making friends, but constantly having to watch himself, you know. And then at the end, I mean, I won't give the ending away, is then looking back on that experience and what that means for him, and then ultimately what it means for the audience.
For the audience, exactly. Interesting that you said in London there were a lot of South Africans who came because they would resonate with that so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, when you said about hiding, it reminds me, and not talking about it, it reminds me a little bit of the Vietnam War, the Vietnam veterans who were seriously damaged and didn't want to talk about it. You hear films, you know, they didn't want to talk about it. So this is quite similar, isn't it?
Look, the border war, it was never an official war in South Africa.
No, that's the weird thing.
That's the weird thing. And I think, I mean, I might stand out of correction, but I have a sense that it was kind of like the Vietnam of South Africa. Mm-hmm. What made it so hard for these young guys that went up there is also the government, and what the news was saying was like, it's all good, it's all fine, everyone's fine.
Absolutely.
And in the meantime, they were going through the worst thing, but also the people within the Boer, you know, the Angolans and, you know, that whole thing. I mean, people, it was a war. People were, and, you know, Kufut and that whole part of the SADF history is it was immense violence, overkill. I mean, no violence is good, but I mean, we're talking about really gory stuff.
Yes.
And that these young boys, 17, 18, 19. I mean, another thing which a lot of people will know is that if you weren't in school at 15, 16, you went to the army.
Yes.
So you could be sick 15, 16 years old, going basic training and then being sent up to go kill people.
Yes.
Crazy.
In a war that you know, don't understand.
Exactly.
Not even the warmongers knew what was going on.
Exactly.
It's almost like, I mean, I remember a friend of mine going to the border at Grootfontein, that whole thing. And I was reading news in those days at the SABC, which in those days was very, very biased, as you may remember. And the news didn't tell us anything really.
Yeah.
And he would write or phone and tell the most horrible stories to the point where you think, well, I don't believe you. Surely it can't be that bad.
That's a terrible place to be. That must have been a terrible place to be.
Absolutely. Let's have another piece of music. Greg, what have you got for us this time?
Right.
Something gentle.
Something gentle. So Metallica is one of my favorite bands, which I thought would be good for Fine Music Radio. But this version of Unforgiven, which has got a lot of war theme in it, is also backed by the San Francisco Symphony. So it's a real merging of these two musical styles. And if you listen to the lyrics, I think it's very powerful.
Well, I didn't run out the studio. Who would have thought that I'd be back announcing Metallica on Fine Music Radio? But it was softened, if that's the word, with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, a piece called The Unforgiven. Once again, war raising its head there. Mm. And another choice of my guest, Greg Carvelis, who's in Cape Town from Berlin, although you are born out here, directing this show called Moffy, a one-man show as opposed to the film at the Baxter Flipside. Oh, incidentally, why have you chosen the flip side of the Baxter? That's the downstairs very small one, isn't
it? It's the one that's on the backside of the Pam Golding stage, the main stage.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yes, yeah. So the reason we chose it is because of the way our lighting and our production and our sound works, is I really wanted the audience to feel like they were in this liminal space of memory. You know, the studio, the Golden Arrow studio, is a wonderful space, but I just needed a bit more just to let it breathe.
And the theater would have been too big.
The theater would have been way too big.
Okay. Yeah. I've never been to that theater, so I'm
It's a stroke of genius by the Baxter management. I think it's a very, very smart move. Mm-hmm. You know, having run a theater myself, and it fits that perfect between the studio and the main. Yes. It just gives shows this size.
Talking about running a theater yourself, it's quite funny. Whenever we talk about The Fugard's new name, which I can't think of a name, we always say formerly The Fugard.
Formerly The Fugard.
Because in the short time it was around, it had a huge impact on Cape Town, didn't it?
Yeah.
And did some major shows, many of which you directed and were involved in.
Yeah. The Fugard was an incredibly special space, certainly to all of us that worked there, and definitely I know for our audiences. Mm-hmm. We worked really, really hard to try and create something and to honor the name of Athol Fugard. As we know, he passed away recently, this year. So that was kind of our mandate. And we were very lucky to have Eric Abraham, who founded and funded the theater and who is funding this production of Morphe, to back us and the team, you know, being led by Dan Galloway and Lamise Albertus.
Is Dan Galloway with you on this as well?
No.
Oh, Dan, because he was at the Fugard.
He was the executive director there.
That's right. Daniel Galloway. You spoke about Athol Fugard, who you must have a soft spot for.
Absolutely.
All of us, great respect. But I saw you did something at the Royal Court Theatre celebrating the life of Athol Fugard.
Yeah.
Where was that?
So that was at the Royal Court in London, and we wanted to honor Athol in London. You know, a lot of his productions ran at the Royal Court in the 70s and the 80s. You know, and the Royal Court and the Fugard Theatre had a sort of a similar kind of mandate, I guess. And certainly before it closed, we were really focusing on more new writing. Mm-hmm. But historically at the Fugard, we did a lot of new musicals and Eric commissioned a lot of new works. And as part of my first season, which sadly was, you know, cut short because of COVID, we were really focusing on more new South African writing.
So it
just felt appropriate, and Eric felt it would be appropriate that in London there was the really beautiful celebration here in Stellenbosch shortly after his passing. And then a few months later, I was very lucky and very honored to be asked to just to pull a program together. We had some amazing people speaking. We had Kai Luke Brummer, who was in My Master Harold and the Boys.
Right. Yes.
He performed a piece there, and the artistic director, David Byrne of the Royal Court, spoke, and many people spoke. So it was just a way to, you know, Athol is such a global name in the theater world, and
very
so important.
So.
And his work now is having a resurgence, especially because of its themes. Mm-hmm. It just felt appropriate.
What do you do in Berlin? Sorry, that sounds a bit vague, but seriously, what sort of work do you do in Berlin?
So I'm based in Berlin. I'm learning German. So my work is mostly based in London and in South Africa. I've worked on a couple of projects. I do a little bit of dramaturgy. I do a little bit of teaching. I've got a project coming up now with the Berlin Shakespeare Company to do a production with them next year.
In German?
In German, as an English director in German, which I'm really excited
about.
Which
play is it?
It's going to be The Comedy of Errors, which is a fun one.
It is.
Yeah.
At least there's a light touch somewhere.
Exactly. So I moved there 2.5 years ago, and as anyone who's moved country knows, it's a really big shift. Mm-hmm. But the bulk of my work has been in Germany, has been around script development and dramaturgy and a little bit of teaching, and then my directing work has been in London and South Africa.
Oh, I see. So you come out here fairly regularly to South
Africa? Yeah, fairly regularly. I did Dear Evan Hansen earlier
That's
this year.
That's right, you did that.
Doing Morphe this year, obviously.
And what about doing this Morphe in German, in Berlin?
I would love to. I would love to. We're working on it.
Because, of course, Germany also has, they're talking about conscripting again.
Absolutely. It's something.
And they've got a tragic war background as well.
Definitely, definitely. It's something we're trying to work on. It's interesting, the Germans, which actually caught me by surprise, especially in Berlin, there's not a lot of English theater. Not as much as you would think. Of course, mm-hmm. there is English theater, but it's incredibly German, which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obvious. So yeah, it's on the cards.
My goodness, imagine that. A play like this, and they would be able to relate to it as well, I think, certainly.
Absolutely.
But just thinking aloud, as it were, you realize, as you've been saying, Greg, what the SANDF did was really quite evil in many ways, not only in the townships, which a lot of these young men yeah. had to deal with as well, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Riding around on those things.
The biffles.
The biffles. Mm. But they were ruthless, the SANDF.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and this is something South Africa is dealing with. I mean, we're dealing with a very particular part of this war and of the SADF in the 80s. But the ramifications for black South Africans, for white South Africans, for all South Africans of that time, and those people are still feeling the effects of it.
I'm sure.
Similarly, the people in Angola and in Namibia. And so, I mean, I think this is, again, and without sort of hammering the point too much, is why it's so important, is because the ripples, you know, it's like throwing a rock in a pond. The
yes.
ripples keep going. You know, yeah. it might feel like it happened a long ago, but people are still dealing with this.
Yeah.
And it has to be acknowledged. And in South Africa, and certainly for me as a theater maker, and that's why Athol's work is so important, is we cannot forget. We've got it. You know, I hear a lot of people, and it's interesting on the YouTube comments and on social media, a lot of people go, you know, why do we have to go over this again? And it's like, because it's important,
mm-hmm.
because that's how healing happens.
As happened with the whole Jewish problem in the Second World War.
Exactly.
Many films were made, things we have to go over this.
Yes.
We can
never forget these things, because when we forget, we get complacent.
Our Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Exactly.
Which
yeah.
was painful
yeah.
for many, many people.
Mm.
Let's have another piece of music. Greg, what have you got this time?
Yes. So we're going slightly more upbeat here. This is one of my favorite. I'm a big fan of dance music. This is a song called Weapons of Mass Destruction by Faithless.
My dad came into my room holding his hat. I knew he was leaving. He sat on my bed, told me some facts. Son, I have a duty calling on me. You and your sister, be brave, my little soldier. And don't forget all I told you. You're the mister of the house, now remember this. And when you wake up in the morning, give your mama a kiss. Then I had to say goodbye. In the morning, woke mama with a kiss on each eyelid. Even though I'm only a kid, certain things can't be hid. Mama grabbed me, held me like I was made of gold, but left her in the stories untold. I said, Mama, it'll be alright when Daddy comes home tonight. Whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your SolarWinds son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You're for the Caucasian or a poor Asian, racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage. Overcome in action is a weapon of mass destruction. In
the skin under my chin is exploding again. I'm getting stressed from some other children. I'm holding it in. We're taking sides like a politician. And if I get friction, we get to fighting. I defend my dad. He's the best of all men. And whatever he's doing the right thing. It's frightening, but it makes me mad. Why do all of these people seem to hate my dad? And if that ain't enough, now I get these spots. I go to sleep every night with my stomach in knots. And what's more, I can hear mama next door explore the radio for reports of war. I know all he ever seemed to do is hide the tears. Seemed like daddy been gone for years, but he was right. Now I'm geared up for the fight, and he would be proud of me if my daddy came home tonight. Listening keenly, whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your SolarWinds son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Caucasian or a poor Asian, racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage. Overcome in action is a weapon of mass destruction.
structure. My story stops here. Let's be clear, this scenario is happening everywhere. And you ain't going to Nirvana or Farvana. You coming right back here to live out your karma with even more drama than previously. Seriously. Just how many centuries have we been waiting for someone else to make us free? And we refuse to see that people overseas suffer just like we. Bad leadership and egos unfettered and free. Who feed on the people they supposed to lead. I don't need good people to pray and wait for the Lord to make it all straight. There's only now, do it right. Cause I don't want your daddy leaving home tonight.
Weapons of Mass Destruction.
Yeah.
Talking about war, goodness me, Faithless, the group Faithless. And that was another choice of my guest, Greg Carvalhos. Well, I suppose war, as we've spoken about,
yeah,
I really find it quite chilling that you said Europe now is like pre-war
Europe. That's what they're saying. I mean, hopefully it doesn't. We don't get there. Yeah. Let's hope both. The men, and isn't it funny how a lot of them are men making...
Yes,
hopefully
all these
not
mistakes.
Too stupid decisions.
Yeah, Greg, I was just thinking, the chap who's playing the role of Nicholas, how has he reacted to it? He would obviously not have gone through conscription.
No, David Viv is a very accomplished actor and an author in his own right, as I said. It's been amazing. You know, David's about 10 years younger than me. I'm 43. I remember the 80s. I remember, as I said, my stepdad and all the men in that family all went to the border. So I grew up with the stories, and David as well in his own way. So, you know, we've approached it from slightly removed. We have Charles in the room and he was there. So I feel like we've got a really good spread of experience.
Yes.
And I think what's been amazing is that we've been able to kind of come at it with a slightly different perspective and hopefully then find something that a whole audience can access. People that were there, people that knew people were there, and maybe people like young audiences, which I'm very passionate about, who need to come to the theater more often, who have no idea about it, have never even heard about this, what this might be. So it's a lot to hold. It's a very big personal story. It's a very beautiful story. It's a very sad story, and oftentimes it's a very brutal story. And David has just approached it with absolute empathy, which I think is so important. He's really come at it with just being almost kind of a conduit for the story to come
through.
Gosh,
I wonder how he feels after a performance, because it must be fairly draining for
exhausted.
Him as a person.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Let alone as an actor.
It's a lot to hold. I mean, no matter what performance you're doing, you know, whether you're doing a piece of ballet or a piece of music, you're essentially a vessel for someone else's work, and you're performing that work. So, yeah, it's a very big job, but he's an incredibly brave actor. He's very passionate and very empathetic, and I think that shows in the role.
Yeah. While that music was playing, we were talking about the fact that you wanted everything to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah.
But did you say some people still come up to you and say, no, that's not how it was? Or?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a piece of theater.
Yeah.
So we're not doing a documentary. We're not doing a biopic.
Right,
it's an adaptation of a book, which is an adaptation of diaries of one particular experience. So it's impossible to capture the entire experience. So everyone, I'm sure, who was there would have had different experiences in the 80s and the SADF. But we are focusing on André Carle's experience and what that experience could mean for many, many people. And then commenting on maybe a broader experience that boys and men that were conscripted in felt. So we've really tried to be as honest, as precise as possible. But it is a piece of theater, and it's really more about what's at the heart of it.
One of the things that interested me earlier, among the many interesting things you said, was the sound of a buffle, for example, that you've managed to create somehow in the theater.
It's the actual sound of the buffle. This is the magic of Charles Johan. He's gone away and he's actually sourced the actual sound. So for people that have never heard a buffle, you're going to hear what a buffle. People that know what it sounds like, I think it's going to bring back quite a lot for them.
Tingle in the spine.
Exactly.
Fear.
Yeah.
What, Greg, are you going to do now when you go back to Berlin, or what is your next project?
So I'm actually working on a project about Ward 22, is the next, and it actually came out of us working on Morphe, and I started to research Ward 22 and went, hang on, I didn't know about this.
Nor did I until
and
you
and I'm going,
it
well, not that I'm the know-all of all knowledge, but I was like, well, I spend a lot of time in this world, so busy working on that.
When you say working on it, are you thinking of writing a play?
It's been commissioned. So myself and Philip Rademeyer, who is working on that with me as well, we're in the process now of developing that in the hope that we can stage it next year.
That's going to be something. You won't be banned, I hope.
Me too.
Greg, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And I'm so looking forward to seeing this. Let me just remind our listeners, it's from the 2nd to the 27th of September, and it's at the Baxter Flipside. So remember, it's at the Flipside, not in the main theater. And it sounds to me to be completely riveting theater, and also the fact that the film has been reduced to a one-man show. Mm. Fortunately, I haven't seen the film, so yeah. I won't go and see it before I've seen the play.
Yes. Yeah.
Greg, thanks very much for all you've shared with us.
Thank you.
And what are we going to listen to?
So we're going to listen to Substitute by Clout, which is very thematic for Morphy, and it's a song that many of the boys and men who were conscripted would have heard over the radio at the time.
They would have been listening to Force's Favorites.
Yes.
With Pat Carr. And the beers on the ice. And so remember all those things for the poor boys on the border.
Exactly.
What a time. Greg Carvalhos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.